Hey everybody, I'm Neil Huff, and I'm an old friend of Michael's. We go back a few decades.
Yeah.
A bunch of decades. I'm a friend of several presidencies and
yes,
musical genres ago.
Indeed.
And I'm really grateful and honored that you've asked me to come talk to you today.
Oh, well, thank you.
About the big... day tomorrow, 10 years ago, October 26, 2012, you guys, meaning your group Bipolar Explorer, released their second album.
That was the second one, yeah.
And that was a, and that album signaled a very new direction for you guys.
Yeah.
So just to go back a little bit, you, when I met you, I think it was before. Were you an Uncle when we met?
I think Uncle started about a year later. I was writing the songs that became Uncle's first live set and then the first album, but the group wasn't all together yet. It was mostly me writing the songs and with a buddy who then wound up being the lead guitarist, but we didn't have our bassist yet and we didn't have our drummer. So yeah. it was the beginning of Uncle, but the songs were there, but the group wasn't yet.
And the drummers weren't there yet.
Yes, the series of Spinal Tap, like, exploding drummers.
Exploding drummers, that might be a recurrent theme in this conversation.
Yes.
So...
As Bipolar Explorer is famously drummerless.
Yes.
So, yes, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Definitely. and you guys, how was your sound different, Bipolar Explorer, would you say, from Uncle? Where was this new direction?
I think, I think a couple of things. Uncle was sort of a power pop punk group in that very sort of Replacements, Husker Du, REM, all those underground 80s bands that we loved, you know, and with, you know, some Wire thrown in there, some post-punk stuff also, late Clash. And when Summer joined the band, it just got her influences were more like Portishead. She was a huge Goldfrapp fan. And it just got to be more sort of a sweeping emotional kind of thing, and then began to get more experimental. Even on Of Love, there's a track or two that begins to signal where that experimental thing will ultimately lead to, you know, what we're doing now, which is very eclectic. Some of it's still that sort of shoegazy songwriting, but there's a lot of experimental influence in the music now as well. But Summer started all of that, because we were really, even the first Bipolar Explorer record was kind of an extension of the Uncle sound, because it was me and Eve, who was our last, Uncle's last drummer, and then once Summer joined the band, it just became a different thing and began to move in another direction.
And when did you and Summer meet?
We met in late 2007. I came out, Summer was in San Francisco, and I came out to San Francisco to work on a play that I wrote, and then stayed at the Magic, where my buddy Chris Smith was the artistic director, and then stayed to work on a play that Summer was in, that Chris was directing, and that's when we first met and fell in love at the Magic, and started, and she was like, "You're in a band? Can I be involved?" And it was like, of course. So, that's how it all got.
Amazing. Going. So she was in your play.
Yeah.
And then in the band.
Yes.
Oh, that's,
yeah.
How long when you met until before she was in the band?
Like, immediately. She was like, "My boyfriend's in a band and I'm not involved." And it was like, well, now you are. Yes.
That's great.
Yeah.
Of course we're in your band.
Yes, I'm in your band, indeed. Yes, yeah. Kind of how it was, yeah.
And did she, what was I mean, how different were your tastes initially?
I think, you know, she liked the stuff that I liked, and she did get into Westerberg a bit too, but her thing about sort of alt rock was like, it's too fuzzy, she'd say.
Interesting.
And she just, she had a, she, I'm, she just opened me up to a lot of things that I was very punk rock snobby about. And and started to really open my mind to some other things. I think we did it for each other. We expanded each other's palettes.
Yeah.
But it changed once she joined the group. I just started writing differently because I was writing for her, and then I was listening to other stuff as well, and that just went in a different place. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember that shift very clearly.
Yeah.
In your music and in you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden there was like, not that what you were doing was dark, because it was light and dark always, but all of a sudden there was a lot more kind of, almost like a different shape was in your music and in your face even. It was wild. The first time I saw you after this was all going, it was like, I knew you were you. But you were kind of a different person.
Yeah,
in a way. There was an elevation of something that was really extraordinary, and I could totally see it reflected in the music.
Yeah.
So, well, how much do you want to talk about in terms of your guy's story, or do you want to just talk about the music, or? About this album, or what the significance of October 26, 2022 is?
You know, the album was ready to be delivered prior to all that, but we decided to hold it because we wanted to do a release party, and which we did down at a club that is no more down on Houston Street called Zierzemin, which I think is Turkish for underground or basement or something like this, and it was run by this guy Jack Martin. It was just a great room, and so we played the show down there, and then that was the official release day. Came out on iTunes, and I think this was pre Bandcamp, so I don't think it came out on Bandcamp that day. It came out later on Bandcamp, but that was the official release, the 26th of October, 2012. Yeah.
Wow. How much time passed from Summer's passing to you beginning working on revisiting this piece?
Yeah. So the initial thought, there were recordings, because Summer and I and Sean Leahy, who was the second guitarist in the band, were working on what we thought was going to be an EP. It was going to be maybe 6 songs, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And we had also had a Psychedelic Furs cover that we thought we might throw in there as well. Yeah.
What was the song?
Run and Run.
Mm. Wow.
And Summers, you know, was sang vocals with me through the whole album, and really knocked it out in an amazing way. Particularly Flag Day was just this great vocal that she added. I mean, the thing of working with her was just that she would know where I was going before I got there, you know, and land on the same page with me, whether I was playing guitar or singing or whatever it was. Just really great to collaborate with.
Yeah.
And so Summer passed in March of 2011, and I just couldn't do anything, you know, let alone pick up a guitar for months and months. And then my buddy Jason kept bugging me, like, you know, could he come see me, and, you know, do we want to play guitar or something? And so he came over and brought coffee, and we plugged in. And then once that happened, it just started being a regular thing. And because it's kind of my job in the band to write songs, I just started writing songs. And then that became revisiting the recordings that we were doing for the what we were calling at that point Flag Day, was because there was the, we're going to use the, that song as the title for the EP, mm-hmm. became mm-hmm. Of Love and Loss, because the material that I was writing was about summer and about us, and it just repurposed the thing. So it was like using the recordings that we'd worked on, folding that in, and not in a chronological way, the whole thing, just, you know, a mixed deck of that, and it became the double album that we know.
Yeah. Gosh, it was only, I'm sorry I interrupted earlier when I said, yeah, I remember, because I was immediately shocked by, looking back, how short that time was, because at the time it felt like, I didn't know how, as your friend, to help you. You were in San Francisco for a while. I was very struck by you telling me that it was only a few months before you started working on this after summer's passing, because at the time it felt anything like anything but a few months. It felt like a couple of years, to be honest with you. I really thought it was, and I remember feeling really excited for you that you were doing it, working on this piece with her again, and then really astonished, well, obviously once I eventually heard it, but also your life took on an even it just your life expanded in a way that I've never seen, really. When you guys met, you were I'd say a different person doesn't really do it justice, but you were just profoundly happy. I mean, light. Happy. Yeah. And you guys just had this rapport that was so apparent. And, you know, it was almost like you were newly in love and had somehow known each other, you know, for a long time. It's very, really beautiful to see. And I was just like, wow, Michael, gosh, what a curveball. You must have never, ever, ever saw this coming.
Yeah. You know, there's a great documentary about Peter Bogdanovich. And they talk about him meeting the woman that he loved, who was, you know, murdered ultimately, but said that, you know, that it changed his life, in because he was a very he wasn't necessarily grim, but he was very serious, and that meeting her, it just changed his, it just lightened him in a way that was amazing, and that it, you know, that it healed all of these broken places in him. And I, when I saw that, it made me think a lot about summer, because I kind of felt very much that way as well.
Yeah, I would say, as your friend, that is exactly what I observed going on, and I was just so...
Dorothy Stratton, I believe, woman's name was, yes.
God, I didn't know that documentary, but that is exactly what happened with you. So, and then after her passing... your life took on such an incredible, almost element of service towards her.
Like
I have this kind of thought in, you know, life, we serve what we love. We serve what we love to do, you know, really just act like, you know, within reason. You have to be yourself and look out for yourself and your own health, but to just serve that which you love. And you did that. And you did that in a way after her passing that was very, very breathtaking.
Thank you.
Yeah. And just your whole world, your whole apartment.
The shrine.
I mean, it was, and you, it's everything became a living shrine, and you truly kept, you know, you kept her with us in the world. People, I only, you know, I didn't know her terrifically well, but, you know, thanks to your kind of mission, your heart mission, you know, that continued my knowledge of her and love of what she brought to the world. And this record is such a, I mean, I remember I was in a play with Anne Bancroft, a two-character play.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You remember
how I remember that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I was going through a really hard time, and she said, yeah, but Neil, you're an artist. That's your gold. And I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, how do you channel unthinkable pain, you know?
Yeah.
And once you started working on Of Love and Loss, that's clearly what you're doing. And I'm very curious, like, I know what that means in terms of how that might work for an actor, mm-hmm. which you are a tremendous actor.
Oh, thanks. Been a while.
Yeah, well, won't go away. But how do you, was it conscious putting yourself into that dedicated space, that shrine space for her, or were you just getting it out? Was it self-expression? Was it something you were communing with her about? Because what comes out in the record, it's just so extraordinarily beautiful.
Thank you.
And crafted. How did you take those footsteps? Were your eyes closed and you're just stepping and hoping that there was going to be a stone out in the river? Or were you mapping it? Were you doing it consciously or just emotionally?
I think, yeah, it more of an intuitive thing, you know, and just that's the what Norman Mailer calls writing the spooky art, because, you know, where does it come from, you know, these mm-hmm. transmissions and lots of things happen too, and it just magical things. I remember that I had a watch that my mom had given to me. My mom, I also lost my mom 10 months before summer, so that was a very difficult year.
Right.
Summer was amazing through all that. I was in London when my mom passed, and she got me back to New York and then to Michigan and met me at the airport in Detroit and everything, and that was an amazing week that she helped me bury my mom, you know, and then 10 months later.
Yeah. So your mom...
Yeah, my mom had given me this watch, and the wristband had broken when I was out in San Francisco, and I just stuck it in my laptop bag. And it was one of those self-winding watches, so if you don't wear it, mm-hmm. it stops running. And I had it on the back of my mantle here one night, and I hadn't had it on in months, and I was very sad. And I was it was really the waves of grief were hitting me. And suddenly I heard it go tick, 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 tick. And things like that. What happened? It doesn't really speak to how to write an album, but things just sort of, you know, they come to you, and it was I didn't know what to do. You know, I felt that I didn't know what I do or how I do it, but like I said, a buddy of mine came over here and started playing guitar with me, and then I just once that started, I just started writing songs, and they started coming out. And I really feel that of all the things that I've done in the arts in my life, this has been the purest expression of my soul, because it's it's not out of any ambition except to honor her, you know? And and you know you're doing things for the right reason when it's not about anything more than just this thing that comes to you, this, you know, spooky thing that you channel, you know? It's not really yours. It's just something that you're an instrument for, I think. You know, it sounds a little airy-fairy, but...
No, it's exactly what it sounds like when you're listening to it.
Oh, thanks.
Exactly.
Thanks.
It's, like I say, it's a breathtaking achievement, Michael.
Thank you.
You And we're also we're talking about something as if you got to work a few months later, but you were in San Francisco for a while, very close to Summer's family.
Yeah, still am. Yes.
Yeah, I don't remember you became a San Francisco Giants fan.
Yeah, big time. Yeah,
your dad, yeah.
yeah.
And went through all that great joy, shared joy with her family. And I didn't even remember when you were finally back in New York. This was not an easy thing.
Yeah.
Point I'm bringing up is I was really, really, really worried for you. I personally was not sure, entirely sure, how you were going to come out, if you were going to come out of this situation, given the circumstances of how everything, you know, just such a hideously sad thing. How do you get past it?
Yeah.
And you don't.
Right. Yeah, you carry it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You fold it in if you're lucky, I guess. I don't know.
It's always there. You just carry it in a different way, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So you know, you finally picked up your guitar and started writing, I remember being very happy just as your friend that there was a great service you could do, as you put it so beautifully, by honoring her. And how much time do you think it was to when you started that work, when I actually heard it?
That's interesting. I think probably first started writing summer passed in March, maybe in July it started of 2011, because the record doesn't come out until the following October. But it was really done by June or July of the year of 2012. We sat on it for a while. Part of it was artwork. And a part of it was
incredible,
like,
artwork.
Yeah, because the cover is the Alex Alemany piece, Mediterranea, which is the woman coming out of the waves, which is what was also the image that struck me. That's how I wrote the song Ocean, which has the end about meet you under the waves, walk all the way to heaven.
No, man.
But that,
it's gone out and my mind's made up.
Yeah. So I think you probably heard it. I had to go out to Seattle to work on the last play that I'd written before summer had passed. And I remember, you know, they were going to do it out there. And I remember my buddy R.J. Tolan, who's an artistic director of Youngblood, said, oh, that's great. Oh, that poor actress. Thinking of the woman who was going to have to, you know, play the part that was meant for Summer. Because it was beat so, whatever. But Summer's mom came up and saw it. She loved it. So it was all good, but you know, it was for her. But like, so I think you probably heard it either before I went out, which would have been in July, or when I got back, which would have been in August, because nobody had heard the final mixes outside of the band but you, and you came over to check in with me and to hang out, and we started to play some of the tracks, and then we just listened to the whole to everything.
And
you urged me to, like, put the whole thing out. Don't, like, you know, decide, oh, here's the single, or, you know, get this down to, like, 8 tracks or something. It's just, like, release all 15. The whole thing needs to be an album. If it's a double album, it's a double album. So, yeah.
Well, it was at least clear to me that it was like alive. It was like tissue.
Yeah.
And there was parts of it here that looked and did this, looked like and did this, and there was parts over here. It felt like a, you know, a living thing.
Yeah.
And isn't it amazing too how something so entirely personal and specific, like, is somehow the thing that hits with people.
Yeah.
And I mean hits, not like a hit, but it's interesting.
It's resonant.
Yeah, it resonates in some deep place. Like just to jump out for a sec, like I'm a big fan also of Sharon Van Etten.
Yes.
And her work is, in some cases, very, very specifically about parts of her life that were very painful, and she's talked about, you know, people resonating with that, and that's her story.
Yeah.
But when I first heard her music, it was just a feeling that I could tell she was in that deep, deep, deep place.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know what the words were, and I was getting this tremendous thing back from experiencing that music. Like, you don't even need to know if it's coming from that root.
Yes.
You know
it. You don't have to have the details. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's so true with this. I felt it. I felt all your godfathers helping you, mm-hmm. you know, your guys. Meaning the artists who've, you know, been pole stars for you. But
yes.
I felt your viscera articulating something that could, you know, it can only be you. And that's why it's just such a profound work in the true sense.
Thank you.
So of course, like, sorry to start a comparison party, but someone was like asking Paul McCartney years later about the White Album, and
yeah.
you know, is that something that you know, would it have been a great, you know, single record? And he's like, it isn't. It's the White Album.
Yeah.
It's all of that. You
yeah.
know, you know, it doesn't. It's not even a thing. Like, you can't. It's just, it is what it is. And, oh God, I hate that expression more than any expression. Please don't repeat that.
That's interesting. It's interesting. But like, Lennon is one of the people who made that phrase what it is, because he used it in a song. It is what it is.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's on Mind Games, I think.
Wow.
I'm going to get you out of this. What's the name of it? I can't think of the name of the song, but it's on Mind Games. But like, there was an article in The Guardian about that phrase, and they also were like dating it to Lennon's lyric in 1974. You know, it's like,
whoa,
that's when they thought it entered public consciousness. So that you're talking about McCartney, and then,
okay,
and that's Lennon's phrase. That's all good.
Yeah, it is good.
I remember that too about the McCartney said they've asked him a few times, but in the anthology they were talking about that, and he's like, you know, well, I'm not a great one for that. You know, it's great. It's sold. It's the Beatles' Bloody White Album. Shut up, or something like that. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And so yours takes on this amazing topography, that it can only be this, and it has highs and lows, and that French word longueurs, and it has you know, the incredible angles and intense privacy and intense commune in it, you know. Anyway, I'm
Thank
crazy
you.
About it, always have been.
Thank you so much.
So happy that you are going to be sharing it again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything you want to talk about in terms of the specifics in here? Hang on.
Yeah.
If I just go. Oh, right. In terms of this, you know, leaving it alone, I think I said something to you along the lines of, like, these things find their narrative.
Mm.
Stylistically.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, in the idea of an album at least does, I don't know if that happens anymore for the most part, but this was clearly the narrative of where you were and how you were at this moment. And did I give you, like, I wasn't like saying you should get a drummer for this, was I? Did I say something?
You did.
I know I felt that way
about
Bipolar Explorer, maybe previous, but did I actually? I don't think I.
There were a couple of tracks that you, and I don't know if Ocean might have been among them. What you just thought, like, drums might help drive it a bit, and it just
didn't explain that. Like, it's not that. But
yeah, yeah, yeah. But it was, and it was listening to the record, and it wasn't so much the whole album needed it, but there were a couple of tracks like that could, you know, maybe use some drums. And we never got around to it. So we never, not that I don't like drummers, but just the project never seemed to need it. And also because it started using, there's a lot of tremolo on Of Love and Loss and sort of the discovery of various delays. And they just started to become the sound wave that sort of rides it and gives you some of that anyway. And I find myself now, I'm not a fan of music with drums a bit. I mean, maybe it's become more of an ambient experimental strands of our music as it's progressed. It's sometimes it's a little startling for me to hear drums, even, you know, and just not in my music or our music, but just at all. It just became that. I'm not sure how or why. Just that was convenient.
Well, it's funny, when I heard it, it made total sense to me.
Yeah.
Why you didn't?
Yeah.
Because I know I felt that. What's the record before this?
Go Negative.
Okay. Yeah.
Which has drums. It's Eve Gerard on drums.
Right.
Great drummer.
So this was the first. So I thought drums. Okay. So let me think back. Because listening to it now, I'm not sure if I had this kind of perception on it, but there's a cycling and circling water energy.
Yes, water. Yeah. Yeah.
That doesn't release because it can't release.
Yes.
Because she's gone from her body.
Yeah.
And it feels to me like giving the satisfaction and completion of something with like syncopation or percussion would allow for release. But this record is saying there is no release from that.
Yes.
And there's beauty in it. You know, this is, it feels like water coming up, tide coming up in against your body, in the back and the front of your body, the way it's sung, the way it is all shaped. It's very, very, it feels like water.
Yeah.
And drums would allow for kind of a false satisfaction, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Drums, to me, like drums, it's almost, this is a stupid analogy, like a laugh track or something, but it's just like they tell you how you're supposed to feel. Yeah. Drums signal what you're supposed to feel, and I think the absence of them allows you to expand and find more colors. Nothing against drummers. I love drummers, but that's just my...
Yeah, and I'll do one small advocate thing about it, is that when I was listening to it again, at the very end of Ocean, I think it is, there's this incredible sound.
Mm.
It just goes like, boom!
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, it just startled me.
Wow.
It, you know, brought me up to the front of my chair, and it was just you bumping into the mic in the live version.
Oh, the live version. That's after Necessary Weight.
That's,
yeah. Song. Yeah, that thanks, man.
Incredible. Is it Necessary Weight?
Yeah, it's after Necessary Weight. I'm reaching for the set list, and the guitar neck hit the mic stand.
Because I know we had that conversation before our drums, and this energy thrilled through me because all of a sudden it was directed at this point. I went, here he goes. And then it wasn't. but there was something very startling about it because you're in this meditative space.
Yes.
Thinking about so much, experiencing so much. I'm all about the craziest, most polyrhythmic stuff in the world, but certainly in this case, it just feels like it's the thing you can't undo.
Yeah.
That is motivating so much of this, it feels like. And drums would kind of falsely say that there's a satisfaction in that, and there isn't.
Right. Yeah.
How do we live with what can't be undone? It's one of the That's kind of the biggest thing we just can't get over, isn't it, in life? That's the hardest stuff we're given. That there's a lot of do-overs in life, and then with the big things, there isn't. We're only here for so much time.
Yeah, well, I think these are two, when these are huge things, and when they confront you in your existence, it really requires you to think about what you believe, you know? And I mean, you really have to examine that. And so also what largely came out of this was me finding my faith, you know, which I won't get into specifically about. We're running out of time on Zoom again.
As soon as you say the God word.
Yes, popped right up there, yeah.
Well, I'd be fascinated to talk to you about that anytime, man. I'd love to know about that.
Yeah.
If it needs to stay personal, and
yeah, it's just, well, I think it's amorphous. It's not, you know, specifically Christian. I think that we have the words that we have to express things that we can't ultimately express because we can't know them. So I think that spirituality, the religion specifically, is important in that regard, in that it gives us a language to use to sort of substitute or fill in for the colors that we can't actually see. We're mortal. They're out of our spectrum. And so they're kind of placeholders. But I have a faith that there's much more going on than we know, and sometimes we get a little hints of it in dreams or just walking around in life. Like suddenly, like, you know, something happens, you know, and like I was telling you about the watch, or, you know, like bird song, or, you know, suddenly I'll smell Summer's perfume or her like body wash, and no one's around. So how is that happening? I just think there's a lot more that we don't know. And I saw you in the year after she passed, and you said something to me about the people that we love who have passed, they're closer than we realize.
Oh.
They're like, they're around, and they're not only are they around, they're a lot closer than we mortally can understand. But they're right. They're just right here. And when we, you know, get to the other side, it'd be like, oh, you were all that time. It was like this close, you know?
That's so funny. Thanks for reminding me that, because I was just going to say that I had this kind of, I don't know, guess, intuition, fantasy, I don't know, that when we're on, if we're conscious, when we're about to pass, that there is some intake of breath of like, it was all so simple.
Yeah.
This is, it was, what was that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, because we know. It's easy to pretend you don't know. And to kind of fritter away those things you're talking about, or not pay attention to them, because we can't rationally explain any of them. But thanks for reminding me of that, because I do wonder if we're going to suddenly go, oh, it was all so much more simple than we made it out to be. Our time here, but that's wonderful. Would you say, do we got to jump off for the next Zoom?
We got like 6 minutes left on this one, so
okay.
We could start. Let's another
do a couple
one.
More minutes. Would you say that when you talk about, when did you come to that sense of what you just expressed? Was that before you started working on this? After? During? You know. How many?
I don't think I would have been able to get through the album if I hadn't some sense of that already. And I think Ocean is about that also, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Meet you under the waves, walk all the way to heaven. It's just like, there's a I don't think I would have been able to ultimately go on if I didn't think that I would find her.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's, the whole thing is searching. And the whole thing is this journey, and you know, we're working on our 11th album now. Sylvia's a super important part of my life. She's amazing, my partner, and is the true third member of the band. And it's a continuing refinement of what do you believe in, and what happens, and explain that, you know. And so it just continues to go on, but I think I can't pinpoint exactly when, but I wouldn't have not been able to make the album if I didn't have that resolve that like this is not over, you know. It's I don't understand it, but there's something more, and it's there, and I'll get there, and I'm offering this up because I have to.
How long is Bipolar Explorer around before Summer joined the band?
I think Go Negative came out in 2006, so we had that, and then I met her the next year, so then we sort of regrouped and started doing something completely different because Eve had been in the band. Bipolar Explorer was really me and Eve. Sean had come in on second guitar. We didn't have a bass player at that point. We had a few people who jammed with us a bit, but then it became Summer and I and Sean, and we were in different cities, so we'd send stuff back and forth like people do now, and like Sylvia and I do from France and New York, and then finally get in a room together and put together things properly. But so it was the Go Negative came out, I think, 2006. I met Summer at the end of 2007, and then Bipolar Explorer started to, reform in the intervening months and years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you know how I responded to the record, and I was so felt so privileged to be the first person outside of the band to hear. I guess, were they the final mixes? Were they masters? Or
I think they. I don't think I'd sent the stuff up to Boston to our guy Scott Craig. That was the first album we worked on with Scott, who's now worked on us all of the Bipolar Explorer albums through Forests, the last one, and the next one coming up, and the two Tremisphere albums with Sylvia. But that was the first one. But I think it was prior to mastering. I think they were basically. It's impossible to come to final mixes. You have to finally make yourself stop. But I think I was at a place where it's like, I think this is good to go, and I was going to play you like one or two, and then we listened to 15 instead. So you heard the whole where we were at. Yeah, and the only person outside of the band at that point to have heard the album.
Well, it was such an incredible moment because one. I was beyond happy that you were involved in something that was, honoring Summer and also you were doing what you're here meant to do.
Yeah.
And you were able, seemingly able to, manage both of those things. Happen, grieving and creating, which is a mystery to me on that kind of level. I don't know how you did that.
Sean said to me at the time, I kept going out and hanging out with him and his wife and their two little girls. It was incredibly comforting to be around people. But I said at one point, I don't know what I'm going to do. And he said, you're doing it.
Oh,
and that was really. Yeah, okay. Well, all right, here we go.
Yeah. So I mean, so when you heard from like one little ant on the sidelines, oh my God, this is profound and beautiful. What was it like for people that didn't know the narrative to have such a strong reaction to the record? What was it like for someone who didn't know you really to have a reaction to this record? Did it feel like they were describing your DNA? Did it feel weird and impersonal? I mean, the critics and stuff were really responding to it. Or was it? Yeah, I'm answering for you. I should just ask the question. Yeah. What was it like to have somebody that at that level of remove respond to something so personal? And,
I think, you know, we're not for everyone. You know, we're a niche band, I think, probably to some extent. But to the people who it does resonate for, I think it resonates very deeply. And sometimes people will reach out to you, I mean, just listeners, who it connects with them on a level because of their own life experience, you know? And then, but then, like, in terms of critics, like Ground Control, for instance, who were one of the first people to get behind us and said such lovely things and was album on there.
Can I quote? Because you can.
You do it.
Okay, so they said this was the most heart-stirring album of the year. It feels and sounds like music that is really from inside someone's own skin, skeleton, bloodstream, and remains the most significantly stirring and addictive musical accomplishment I've come across in some time. And to that I say, amen. I mean, that is like
thank you.
Exactly what it is like experiencing your record. So
thanks.
Right on, Ground Control.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's a few other. Irene Trudell was a big champion of ours
FMU, early on, right?
From WFMU. And then, you know, and then other people through the years have also. It's Max Reinhardt from BBC Three and Soho Radio, who's said some really lovely things about us. And one of my favorites was when, you know, we used talking about the, you know, the individual members of the group. And he said, Summer Seraphin, who's still there, which was like very gratifying. I mean, other things that he said that were very sweet about the work, but just like, you know, the presence is felt. It's, you know, it's she's here, and he's 1,000% right. She's absolutely here.
Yes, which is exactly. Got it. So what are you? What is different about tomorrow? The 26th of October, 2022. Are you going to re-release the record in its original form? What are you thinking? Are you re-releasing?
It's out there, so there's not a remaster of it or anything.
So it's just, this is an honoring of the anniversary.
Yeah, it's just sort of us, you know, taking a moment to observe that the album came out 10 years ago, and I did do a mini solo set, 7 songs from the album live, that we're gonna, that's the new release. We're gonna release that tomorrow, the 26th.
I gotcha.
And that's through Slug Records, and then Bandcamp is where you most likely be able to find that.
And was that, sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
When was that recorded?
Last week.
That was live last week?
Yeah.
You're kidding.
Nuh-uh, no. Yeah.
Michael, I had no idea.
Yeah, I did it last week and then sent it up to Boston, and Scott mastered it and indexed it so that you can, you know, actually, like, I want to hear track 3 instead of just the whole thing as one long thing, but yeah.
I thought that was the performance that I was at back...
Oh,
when you first performed.
Oh, like at Zierzeman? No.
Yeah.
No, because that would have been Eva and Jason too. So yeah, that's not.
Yeah.
We don't have a live. We don't have a live recording of the release party, which was like huge. What a fucking night that was! It was amazing.
And Jack unbelievable
played
sets
in between us, and we played the whole album. We did 2 sets. We played the whole album in its entirety in sequence twice, and it was exhausting. But like, you know, in the best way possible. And Eva Potter was playing bass with us then, and importantly had a car. Always good to have a band member with a car. So, and she had a convertible.
Is she the one in the photo that I sent you?
No, that's Harley Johns, who's was a buddy of Jason's, and that was one of our famous couch concerts we used to do for that first year after Love and Loss. We used to do shows here at the Shrine.
Yeah,
what we call couch concerts. Invite people over. We had food. We'd go up on the roof and we'd play a set. You know, maybe sometimes two sets here in the apartment. But no, that was Harley. But yeah, that night of the Of Love release, we were there talking to everybody till 1-2 in the morning, loaded out. It's the 26th of October, so it's near Halloween. It's a Friday night. We load out into Eva's convertible and drove up through the city, you know, through the West Village and through Chelsea and through Times Square to Hell's Kitchen. And people were out in, you know, Halloween costumes. It was just, it was warm. It was like this incredible night. And we came here and she parked the car and we busted all the stuff up five flights of stairs back up to the apartment. And Jason ran down and got sandwiches and beers. And we watched Hard Day's Night together.
Oh my God! Wow!
Yeah, and then we all went up on the roof, and watched the sun come up. And it was, I mean, it felt like summer had been with us all night, you know. And but particularly then, you know, as we were up there, and it was a real magical night to have, you know, played these songs out and launched the album. So that was what was particularly special about the 26th was that. Great show, you know, and having everybody there, and then, you know, and then we were just too excited to sleep, so, you know, we stayed up all night. Yeah
Beautiful, man.
Thanks.
So yeah, this recording is, well, that's, I'd forgotten all the stuff around it
because
just fully out of context hearing it the other night. What song was it? My daughter picked up her blue ukulele. She's 2.5 and started playing along.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I'll send you a photo.
Oh, I gotta see.
Yeah. She started playing along. I forget it might have been Necessary Weight. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But she just started strumming with her thumb, two strings.
Yeah.
Going along with the rhythm. And I thought that was amazing. That someone's hearing this and playing along to it.
That's awesome.
A 2-year-old kid.
I love that.
Yeah. That's so anyway, what I was saying about hearing it, the performance felt as perfect and beautiful as and personal and impossible. How is Michael actually able to do this? As it did when I saw you at Zerzamin.
Yeah.
It's just so, I'm in awe. I'm in awe and forever sorry and grateful for all of this.
Thank you.
What did I want to ask you also? You mentioned the Counts concert thing. I kind of was toying with the social media thing, something I was in, kind of very social, kind of activism component. But I don't know why, it's just not really my thing. But during the pandemic, I got really into seeing friends perform on Instagram Live and stuff.
Yeah.
Her friends and artists that I like.
Yeah. Lowe was doing a thing on Fridays, which they named after the Cure song and said, it's Friday, I'm in Lowe instead of Love.
Oh, wow.
And those shows were great. And they were all, they're very quick, you know, like 20-minute things. And it's just like iPhone study, you know, on a little tripod or something, and they just played in the basement. And it was fucking awesome. And those were great ones. Also, Ben Gibbard was doing, from Death Cab, was doing shows every week too for a month or so, a couple of months during the pandemic. And those were really cool too. Both of those were really fun to watch.
Joe Pernice, David Gedge at The Wedding Present.
Yes, you turned me on to David Gedge.
I just learned from that too that he and I share the same birthday.
That's awesome.
Close to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
23rd.
You're the 25th. So yeah, close. I've got Pacino and Ella Fitzgerald.
That's great. I've got Shirley Temple, and who else is it?
Shakespeare's right around here, right?
Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And Roy Orbison. That's it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's a good trifecta.
For sure.
You know, and Jeff Tweedy was doing that with his family, these concert kind of things with him and his son.
Yes, kids play.
His wife, of course.
Yeah.
So, along the lines of your couch concert thing, have you thought about doing anything like that?
You know, we haven't played out in a while. So, like this live thing that I did that, you know, will be available tomorrow on Bandcamp, 7 songs from Of Love, is the first inkling we've had kind of to play live at all. But
please do.
Thank you. You know, like some of our radio friends, particularly out in California, KFJC, they're all like, you know, when this pandemic finally ends, you gotta come out. Both bands, Tremister and Bipolar Explorer, need to play live. Yeah. They got a place called The Pit, which is their, you know, their live venue, and you have to play live on the air. And also because we sent Carson Street, who's one of the main DJs on KFJC, the live thing, he just responded yesterday. It's like, I really feel like I'm there, you know. So we'll probably get around to it.
Yeah, and I hope you can play in you know, in a way that, you know, you can share it with more people that can just get to a club, because bring us there.
I like venues that are non-traditional, and that part of that is my formative years in DC and going to shows at the Wilson Center, and, you know, people having house shows, and it's just different. I mean, I loved being an uncle and playing bars and playing CBs and all that stuff, but it's so different to play art galleries and house shows, and just where people are there for the Zimmerman was like that, because they had a music room, and you know, if you wanted to be a knucklehead and you know, get drunk and yell at the television, you were welcome to do that at the bar, but like not in the music room. So I like it when it can be about the music. So but I've always felt that, you know, since the 80s. So it's like, it's not a new thing. So if we do that, you know, well, that's, we want to do it in a way that we're comfortable with, you know, because that's the kind of shows that I like to go to also, you know, so.
But what about the online thing? Do you have a predilection for that, or?
We haven't broached that yet, but I mean, it's something.
Tremosphere, that would be
amazing. Yeah, thanks. Well, maybe that's something that, and Sylvia's a little more adept at the technical aspects of that than I. So
turn your phone on. It's not really terrifically tough. Don't worry.
All right, good. Thank God.
You can already do the profoundly hard stuff.
All right.
Don't worry.
Yes. I just play my guitar, you know?
Yeah. You share your gifts, and she'll turn the phone on. And she'll share hers. I think it would be great. You guys could do it at odd hours and stuff too.
Yeah.
Because obviously, she's got people who listen to her across the Atlantic. Well, anyway, anything else you want to cover?
Yeah, just to wrap up, it was really special going back and playing these songs the other day. I mean, because what happens, you do an album, and that's another thing too about live, and we love making albums, I mean, and are very respectful of the form. I mean, I think, you know, the Spotifyization of music, you know, like you put out a single. It's like, I'm more interested in albums, you know, because you have this narrative, you think about it, and about the sequence and the narrative, and, you know, what you're telling, the story that you're telling. And I love making albums. So there's that. But it was really interesting. But then, you know, you move on to the next thing and you don't listen to your music again after you've listened to it like a scientist for months when you're working on the mixes. Yeah. For years sometimes. And it's like, oh, wow, that's, I forgot that we did that, you know, or that guitar part or, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. whatever it is. So that's interesting. But it's really interesting to revisit these songs and very emotional to play them because it's been little while. But the other larger thing that I want to say is that it's so important that Sylvia, you know, came into my life 7 years after losing Summer, and that it's it was impossible for me to ever imagine that that would happen. And immediately we were so simpatico. And immediately, you know, I was hit by a car and was in my, had a pulmonary embolism. I was dead for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And we just were thrown into this maelstrom of surviving together. Yeah. And Summer's parents adore her. Linda's first words to Sylvia were, "Welcome to the family."
Oh, wow.
And, I think, and I've said this a few times, that I think the 10 different musicians have come and gone out of the ranks of Bipolar Explorer over the years, but Sylvia feels like the true third member. And it's when the three of us, when I'm mixing Summer's vocals, because Summer's on every album, you know, I have all these isolated tracks at first, so I always, you know, find a place to fly her in and as I write new mm-hmm. material. But when Summer, Sylvia, and I are all together, you know, and I'm mixing it, it really feels like, you know, one voice. It really, and she's an enormous part of this project, Sylvia is, and in addition to the project that we began, Tremosphere, outside of Bipolar Explorer, and then Sylvia also joined Bipolar Explorer. So the three of us are this, you know, we'll just keep making records. We're making one now.
Yeah. Oh, great. Great. Well, it's gorgeous and it's beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm grateful to you for asking me to come remember it, you know, before the 26th.
I'm grateful to you for participating. Thank you so much, Neil.
Yeah, well, it's just amazing, Michael.
Thank you.
Yeah, your mom, Summer, and then Sylvia getting hit by that car, the pulmonary embolism. You got
it's a lot of material.
It's a lot of material. You will never get to the end of your days and say, "I just didn't have anything to write about."
Yes, I just, you know, I couldn't think of anything.
Yeah, I didn't have anything to get over and get through, and it's not get over. We know that,
right? Yeah, you carry it.
Yeah. All right, man. Lots of love to you. Thank you.
You too. Thank you, Neil.
Congratulations on tomorrow.
Thanks, man.
And I'm so glad you're sharing these live tracks because they felt so immediate and beautiful. And I thought, God, how does he do it? How do you actually open your mouth and let out song, you know, when you're connecting to this? It's breathtaking.
Thank you. Thank you so much.